Now, on 198 Longwave and DAB Digital Radio, it's time for the Daily Service, led by the Reverend Sharon Grenham-Toes. Here on Radio 4 FM, it's our Book of the Week. Chris Stewart reads from his memoir, Last Days of the Bus Club. Chris and his wife Anna have been living in the ruggedly beautiful region of the Alpujarras in southern Spain for 25 years. Chris's first memoir, Driving Over Lemons, told the story of the early days of the farm and soon established his reputation as a writer. The locals love the fame it's brought to the region, but will they ever let Chris forget that they are storytellers too?
One of the key principles of country living is always to have time for one's neighbours, though it's not always an easy one to follow. One day recently, I was hurtling out of the valley late for an appointment with the dentist. Antonio, my neighbour Domingo's cousin, was sauntering down the track and signalled me to stop. I wound down the window and he leaned on it, idly flipping the long end of his horse's leading rope and grinning. It was one of those grins with a little more depth and complexity than his everyday grin. There was purpose of some sort behind it. "We could do with a little rain," I offered, non-committally. No, it's fine. Plenty of grazing still. You'll be okay over at El Valero anyway." The mention of the name of my farm seemed to help him get into his stride. "I'll tell you why El Valero got his name," he continued. "Lord," I thought, "I've lived here for God knows how many years now, and I'm late for the dentist, and he goes and chooses this moment to tell me how my farm got its name." These days, I get told a lot of stories. The locals know that I write books about the Alpujarra, and the notion of having your story written down seems to exercise a peculiar appeal. Indeed, I had no longer managed to shake Antonio off and was racing towards the town when, just past the banana grove at El Granadino, my old friend José Parra, a man who rather oddly keeps a lorry in his front room, leapt out into the road before me.
"Cristóbal, ¿qué tal? Hey, I've got something to tell you."
I looked pointedly at my watch. José Parra looked as if whatever he was about to tell me had been carefully rehearsed.
"You know, there used to be a mill up the river, beyond your place."
I arrived an hour late for the dentist, which, as it happened, was no bad thing, as he too was behind, and so I only had to wait another 20 minutes. Occasionally, though in truth not often, someone will tell me a story that etches itself deep into my mind and either illuminates or throws long shadows over the place I call home. Such a story was told to me by Rogelio, a sheep farmer who lives up on Cerro Negro, the Black Hill. I've known him for years, for he had a little flock of sheep that I used to shear, and I relished the few afternoons we spent together. Inevitably, the day arrived when I had to announce that I was hanging up my shears and would no longer be able to shear the flock. He took this stoically and, after I had finished, invited me to watch the sun dropping low on the Contraviesa and share a few glasses of rough country wine. We'd been sitting for a while in contemplative silence when I asked him if he had always lived at La Palma, his cortijo.
"No," he replied. "I bought this farm 45 years ago for 5,000 pesetas. I was born way over there," and he indicated the great range of rolling blue hills to the south. "We lived in a very remote spot, just the three of us, my brother, my mother and me."
"And your father?"
"My father died before I was old enough to know him. As I said, there were just the three of us, and we had no other family anywhere near."
"I say no family. We didn't even have any neighbours. It was that far out.
Then, when I was 8 years old, my brother 10, our mother fell ill and went to a hospital in Granada. The doctors told her that she would not leave there and would die there very soon. Her last wish was to see her sons before she died. So somehow she managed to find a taxi driver to come to the Contraviesa and take us back with him to Granada. When we arrived in the city, and we had never been in a city before, our mother was already dead. The taxi driver told us we owed him 8,000 pesetas.
8,000 pesetas, I cried. "But that's more than you paid for this farm."
"That's what he said we owed him. 8,000 pesetas. How were my brother and I to know what this meant? We were children. But the man was a monster to take such cruel advantage of a couple of children who'd just lost their mother. Well, said Rogelio quietly, that was what this man wanted, and my brother and I vowed that we would pay him every peseta. And we did. He looked up and smiled in the gentle way that he had. I wanted to weep. I thought of those two children alone in the world and walking from Granada back to the Contraviesa. It would have taken them 2 or 3 days, probably, with no money, no food. And I thought of the monstrous heartlessness of the taxi driver. And then I looked at Rogelio. He bore no rancour, was not eaten to his soul with desire for vengeance against this appalling injustice. So how did you pay off the debt? We worked at whatever we could find for years and years, keeping nothing for ourselves, until it was eventually paid. For a long time afterwards, I would mull over this story of Rogelio's. It moved me deeply, but I found that whenever I tried to relate it to others, great gaps seemed to appear in the narrative. How had the children managed to find their way home? How had they not only supported themselves, but managed to pay off such a huge debt? The more I thought about it, the more convinced I became that I should revisit the story with Rogelio. In fact, the episode had revived a dormant but cherished ambition that I had nurtured long before I'd written any stories of my own, to collect the tales told by the old folk about life on the mountain farms when they were teeming with people. I used fondly to imagine myself trudging the rocky ways of the Alpujarra, armed with pen and notebook. I would seek out the old folk, and they, bent over their mattocks, or leaning on the bar in remote village taverns, would share with me their stories of the past. Anthropological ethnography, I think the term is. But, as so often happens, other more pressing tasks intervened, and I found myself delaying, and then delaying again, the launch of my grand project. I didn't see Rogelio for a long time. And then, one day, our dogs, Bumble and Bow, decided to head off into the hills on their own and disappeared. I had made myself hoarse from shouting their names and was pretty fed up with searching, when an Englishwoman who lived up on Cerro Negro rang to say that Anna was lying beneath the shade of a hedge in her garden and could I go and fetch her. Having established that she was talking not about my wife, but one of our dogs, who have collars with the name Anna and our telephone number, I prepared to set out, initially irked by this long errand. But then I realised that the hedge in question was not far from Rogelio's farm. This was too good an opportunity. I would visit him and flesh out the story I had begun. I printed it out and, armed with a brand new pen and notebook, set off. Parking on the edge of the track up on Cerro Negro, I set out on foot for the final stretch to Rogelio's farm. I called out loudly as I approached the house, this being the accepted etiquette for approaching an isolated cortijo. Shortly, Rogelio emerged, holding an armful of laundry and a bag of clothes pegs. His wife was having trouble with her legs, apparently, and was bedridden. So Rogelio was now her full-time carer and did all the housework, as well as tending the farm. All this at 82. Cristobal, he said, turning to me with a weather-beaten smile. It's good to see you, but what brings you all the way up here? It can't be to waste your time talking to an old man like me, surely. But it is, Rogelio, it is. You remember that story you told me when I was last here, the one about your mother and the taxi driver?
I do, he said, with a peg in his mouth.
Well, I think it's such a wonderful story that I would like to write it down and perhaps include it in a book with other stories like it. And I wanted to ask you if you'd have any objections.
Why would I object, Cristobal? So long as I don't come out of it too badly, as a villain, for example.
Oh, no, 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 of course not, Rogelio. In fact, you come out of it rather as a hero. But I'd like to clarify a few details. Would it be okay if I asked you some questions?
Why, of course, Cristobal. I have nothing in particular to do and nowhere to be going. So why don't we do it right now?
And he beckoned me over to a couple of low, rush-seated chairs in the deep green shade of a carob tree. I was itching to get down to the nub of the business, but it doesn't do to be too hasty.
one must deal with the social niceties first. Well, the social niceties kept us at it for the best part of 45 minutes, until finally I reached into my bag and drew out the printed pages. Let me read what I've already written. You'll see that you come out of it pretty well. Rogelio turned in his chair and leaned forward on his stick to listen. I unfolded the paper and started to translate. He nodded his head with a smile at the mention of the 5,000 pesetas that his farm had cost him. I read on. We lived in a very remote spot, just the three of us, my mother, my brother, and me.
That's wrong, he interjected. We were five children. My elder sister was 17 when our mother died.
Oh, I thought you said you only had one brother.
I was a bit shaken that I got one of the most fundamental aspects of the story completely wrong. Could my Spanish really have been so bad when I first heard this tale? I continued reading. We didn't even have any neighbours. It was that far out.
No, it wasn't, interrupted Rogelio. We lived on the edge of the village. There were lots of neighbours.
I stopped and looked at him. The carpet was being pulled out from under my feet. If there were neighbours, then the drama and pathos of the story would be considerably diminished. A little less confidently now, I read on. The doctors told my mother that she would not leave the hospital, but would die there very soon. Her last wish was to see her sons before she died.
No, said Rogelio. We never went to Granada. We never saw our mother alive again after she went to the city.
I lowered the printed pages and stared at him.
And the business with the taxi driver? The 8,000 pesetas that you spent your whole childhood repaying? What about that?
What taxi driver?
I was clutching at straws now. The taxi driver who took you to Granada to visit your mother in hospital.
I just told you. We never went to Granada.
As for the 8,000 pesetas, well, yes, we owed it to people who had lent us money or helped us out, and we vowed to pay every last duro of it. In fact, we paid it all off within the year. It was a hell of a good year. We had a terrific harvest of figs.
Well, I'll tell you now that I was mighty pleased that things had turned out so well for Rogelio and his siblings in the end. But there was a disconsolate feeling welling up in me at the utter rubbishing of my cherished tale. I think I must have let the disappointment show in my face.
The soldier shot our dog, offered Rogelio, as if that would rescue the tale.
This was scant comfort, to say the least. How could I have got the story so wrong? As I continued along the Cerro Negro track to fetch our dogs and made my way back down the hill and across the river, I mused over how my version of Rogelio's story was pretty typical of the way things were in rural Spain in the long, bad years after the Civil War. So, I don't feel that I have deceived you, patient listener, and I hope I have given you some sense of the difficulties we anthropological ethnographers face.
Last Days of the Bus Club was written and read by Chris Stewart and abridged by Pete Nichols. The producer was Karen Rose, and it's a Sweet Talk production for BBC Radio 4. And tomorrow, the farm that Chris and Anna had nurtured so lovingly comes under threat when the longest drought in recent memory is broken with a vengeance. In a couple of minutes, we explore the evolution of the teenager from 1945 to today. And the science writer Gaia Vince talks about her travels across the world, looking at how humans are changing the environment. It's all in Woman's Hour after the news. On Sunday morning, over on our digital sister station, Radio 4 Extra, This American Life pulls up at a rest stop on the New York State Thruway to hear more stories of the everyday people who work there, as well as those just passing through.
Stan is sitting on the bench in front of the parking lot. Unlike everyone else you see, people looking to eat, looking to get to a washroom, Stan looks perfectly at home. He's waiting for his girlfriend, who he likes to call...
The War Department.
And by which you mean...
It's my girlfriend. The War Department, or the wife, is the War Department. The sky is very clear and blue today. That's not blue. That's not blue. It's not clear.
Have you guys been arguing a lot in the car?
No, we never argue. She told me to say that.
This American Life is over on BBC Radio 4 Extra this Sunday morning at 11.